This is now overhead number 7 of chapter 13. We're basically in the middle of it, and I want to get through the rest of it and all of chapter 12 today. This is talking about the heterotrimeric. Why do they call it heterotrimeric? What does the word myrrh mean? Part. So what is a monomer? What is a dimer? What's a polymer? What is a trimer? What does a heterotrimeric mean? What's the difference between heterotrimeric and homotrimeric? Three different things as opposed to three similar things. That's correct. All right, so what is a mermaid? I know, but what is it? Part maid or part maiden. What's a merman? Part man. So mermaid actually has some significance in Latin terminology. Thank you very much. Okay, so what turns off the active alpha subunit? What turns it off? When does that get turned off? When is it turned on? Okay, so let's review. The alpha subunit is turned on when GTP is attached to it. The alpha subunit is turned on when the GTP is attached to it. Now, notice I'm saying that for both the alpha stimulatory and the alpha inhibitory. In other words, you can turn on an alpha subunit that has an inhibitory function. And it's still on. It's just designed to turn something else off. Now, what causes it? So is that GTP there permanently? Is the alpha subunit, once it's bound with GTP, is that a permanent situation? No. Because the binding site for GTP contains a GTP ACE, which at a constant low activity will spontaneously change that GTP to a GDAVP. Yes? I'm not anti-semantic. Now, it is a whole new GTP that binds, and it occurs back here. All right. The normal, I guess the majority of the situation is the fact that this thing is turned off and it has a GDP residing there permanently. Well, not permanently, but it's residing there. It's docked in the harbor with a GDP attached to it. A conformational change allows that GDP to be ejected and the GTP to be attached. Right. So there's not a synthetic capacity here. There's only a degrading capacity. Thank you for that question. So you got the GTP that's bound and that turns on, in this case, adenylate cyclase. In an inhibitory mechanism, the same process with that alpha subunit that has an inhibitory function will slow down the slow down that adenylate cyclase. Are there any questions about this process right here or this process right here in terms of its activity and how it accomplishes its task? Any questions about that? Yes. I didn't hear the first word you said.
The toxin?
This?
Yeah, right there. It has to go over to the...
this one?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
The toxin has to be there for the GTP to go to GDP, right?
No.
It doesn't have to?
No. The natural activity is for the GTP to be hydrolyzed to go to the GDP. And the GDP stays there and then changes the conformation of this thing and it goes back to the inactive form. What happens here is this cholera toxin blocks the GTPase activity. And so the permanent state, as it were, in the presence of that cholera toxin is that G subunit stimulatory alpha. That's what the GSA stands for, GS alpha stands for. Has that GDP permanently there? The blocking stops the active ACE and the GTP is permanently there, leaving this thing always on. The toxin that helps it stay on. In other words, what this stop sign is, it's blocking the ACE activity. Over here, this toxin is blocking the GDP release, and so it stays in this form right here. It stays in the trimeric form because there is no GTP release being substituted for it. That's what the pertussis does. Now, what's another name for pertussis? What's the common name for that disease? Whooping cough. Have you ever heard a baby with whooping cough? Is anybody? You have. Where did you hear it? Oh, they had an audio of it? What did it sound like? Oh, it was the worst thing ever. Now, how long was the clip? A couple seconds? Yeah. Well, can you imagine having a child, your child, do that for 24 hours a day for as long as that child lives? Till he dies or somehow gets over it. Days and days and days of... I can't even imitate it. It's like you're coughing up a lung. It was horrible. And there are people who refuse to take that vaccine. There are people who refuse to take it. It is the stupidest, short-sightedest. Do you like that word? New word? Short-sightedest? Yeah, thanks. Very good. All right. Well, anyway. So we got to go on, though. Because so what? We make cyclic AMP. So big, hairy deal. That cyclic AMP is known as a second messenger. Second messenger. The second messenger is this thing right here. Cyclic AMP. Just has to make four of them. Cyclic AMP doesn't have to be four molecules to be a cyclic, to have be a second messenger. Cyclic AMP is the messenger. Cyclic AMP then, high levels of cyclic AMP attached to this thing called R2C2. Circle it and write down PKA. Capital P, capital K, capital A. Protein kinase A. PKA. Protein kinase A. Write it down. Also under R2C2, write down, and this is a long one, so give yourself plenty of room. Cyclic AMP or CAMP dash dependent. So it says cyclic AMP dependent protein kinase. PKA and cyclic AMP dependent protein kinase are the same enzyme. Now, this enzyme has a unique character to it. And you'll see this in a diagram I gave you to do. Matter of fact, I think it's... This thing has got... Okay. All right, I'm drawing a box... I've drawn two horizontal lines, dividing the box into four pieces. This box in four pieces, I cut off a corner of two of the pieces and made a slanted line. The other two corners I cut off and made a curved line. Now, I'm going to call this, the slanted line, regulatory, and this, the ones that had the curved line, I'm going to call catalytic. So, the diagram is this PKA... Or, what's it also known as? What PKA and also known as? Cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase is a a multi-subunit enzyme in which two of the subunits are regulatory and two are catalytic. Under the influence of four cyclic AMPs, the cyclic AMPs bind to the regulatory subunit and the molecule falls apart into four different pieces. Okay? So you got the R, you got your R, you got your C, you got your C, you got cyclic AMP here, you got cyclic AMP here, you got cyclic AMP here, cyclic AMP here. All right, so when cyclic AMP binds to the regulatory subunit, conformational changes occur, and that tetramer falls apart, and you get two catalytic subunits that then begin to act. This process is reversible, that these cyclic AMPs can also fall off depending on the level of cyclic AMP. So this whole process is reversible. So again, the inactive PKA, or cyclic AMP dependent protein kinase, is the regulatory units cause the catalytic units to be inactive when they are associated in that tetramer. High levels of cyclic AMP bind to the regulatory subunits, cause that entire molecule to fall apart, and you get two catalytic subunits that then go on to do the activity. You can see that here mathematically. Notice what they've got right here. They've got an R2 CAMP4. That's not an accident. The devil's in the details, ladies and gentlemen, plus two individual C units. That's these things right here. Those C units actually are the catalytic subunit. They are a kinase, which means they do what? Which means they do what? Add a phosphate to proteins. Now, notice it says a protein kinase. The reason why it says a protein, the cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase, I think is more descriptive than PKA. But notice what the term is, cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase. Do they tell you what protein? No, it just says protein. That's because these things are phosphorylating a wide subset of proteins, any number of them. Many of them we probably still don't know. And many of them are dependent on what species you're talking about. So, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know, this claims that when under the influence of that kinase, it takes an inactive non-phosphorylated protein, adds a phosphate to it, under the getting the phosphate from a high-energy ATP, and you make that phosphoprotein, now that phosphorylated protein says it's active. And then it's got a stop sign, a green sign says cellular response. Don't be fooled by this process. This seems to indicate that the protein, if it's not phosphorylated, when it's phosphorylated, becomes active. I can show you processes, and you will see them. Matter of fact, you've memorized them in the glycogen phosphorylase pathway, in which an enzyme becomes inactive when it gets phosphorylated. So be aware that the inactive and active can be switched, and many times is switched, so that this goes from active to inactive. How does that? Since this is a covalent modification and requires an enzyme to do it, the reverse process must also require an enzyme to do it. Is that correct? So what enzyme cleaves off that phosphate group in order to get inactive? What is it? Phosphoprotein phosphatase. Again, they don't name the specific protein that does it, which means this is a generalized protein phosphatase that acts on a wide variety of proteins, not limited to any particular one. There are specific ones. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there are specific phosphoproteins, phosphatases. There are specific enzymes that are actually catalyzed by high levels of cyclic AMP. I mean, stimulated by high levels of cyclic AMP. Just not here. All right. So this is the whole process. There's a tremendous cascade right here. And ladies and gentlemen, this is just the beginning. It's just the beginning. Now, what I told you, if you remember, I have asked you to memorize those pathways. And you're going to find some use of them in graduate school just like that. But this is where this is beginning. As you begin to understand and we relate the regulatory mechanisms with the pathways, that's where the power of memorizing pathway will come in the fact that I will be able to talk to you about the pathway and specific enzymes that are controlled by these small molecules while having you to go, oh, what, huh? Well, you may do that, but it's not my fault. I asked you to know it. Okay, let's go ahead, shall we? We have one more pathway, ladies and gentlemen, we got to know. Well, this is exactly the same thing, isn't it, Dr. Novak? No, not exactly. There's another G protein coupled second messenger system releasing IP3 and calcium. Now, this G protein, that's the same thing as saying that heterotrimeric G proteins. Okay, when they say G protein, they're talking about that trimer. Releasing an IP3 and inositol triphosphate. Now, just as a heads up, what I gave you to memorize is ever so slightly different than what's listed here. All right? They gave you, what do they call this? I think they just call this what? Inositol triphosphatase. Inositol polyphosphate 5-phosphatase. I mean, okay, so they've decided to actually nail this to some particular enzyme, but the idea is still there. Any rate, so guess what? Here's an external signal. Oh, look at that. Look at that. G proteins there. Got the trimer. You got the GTP replaced. Notice it becomes active. There is a small molecule in the membrane that's got both a lipid tail and a phosphoprotein material, inositol phosphoprotein. That's a sugar with 3-phosphates on it attached to a diacyl or di fatty acid tail. Okay, under the influence of this alpha subunit, it turns on an enzyme called phospholipase C. Phospholipase C. Do you remember from the lipid chapter, there was phospholipase A1 and a phospholipase D and a phospholipase A2 that acted on phosphomembranes, phospholipids. Remember what a phospholipid looked like? Phospholipid has a backbone. What's the name of the backbone in a phospholipid? There are actually two of them. What's one of the backbones in the phospholipids? What is it? Glycerin, exactly correct. What's the other one? It's the basis for ceramide. What's the other what's the other backbone that's used? Phospholipids. It's the basis for ceramide. Sphingosine, thank you very much. We're not talking about sphingosine here. So this is a fatty acid tail. This is a fatty acid tail. This is a phosphate. This is the head group. Okay, in this case, this head group is phosphoinositol, which is a sugar phosphate on it. And so these various lipases attack this at different locations, and I don't remember them myself. But there, phospholipase A1, A2, C, and D. So this is phospholipase C. What happens with this? This phospholipase C acts on this glycerol backbone di-fatty acid tail inositol, phosphoinositol group, and it acts on it and releases this IP3, inositol triphosphate, and leaves a DAG, diacyl glycerol, there. Turns out that this IP3 is a soluble second messenger, but this DAG turns out to be a membrane-bound second messenger, in which the let's take a look at what happens with the IP3. The IP3 is then released into the cytosol. It binds to an IP3-gated calcium transport channel that exists in the endoplasmic reticulum membrane. And what happens in this endoplasmic reticulum, here's the cell nucleus, endoplasmic reticulum. There is a relatively high level of calcium ion that is stored in the endoplasmic reticulum. Both the outside of the cell and the interior of the endoplasmic reticulum have relatively high levels of calcium, but the actual cytoplasm of the cell has a low calcium concentration. And because it's got a relatively low concentration of calcium, calcium can act as a second messenger if that goes up. This is why in a nerve transmission, do you remember how synapsis works? Yeah, the voltage-gated comes along, acts on a what channel? Calcium channel, allows calcium to rush in near the synapsis and causes the vesicles to fuse, releasing the neurotransmitter. Well, that's because there are pumps that keep calcium relatively low in the interior of the cell. This occurs in a wide variety of cells. So in the endoplasmic reticulum, it's fairly high storage, fairly high concentration in the lumen, low storage in the cytosol. So the IP3 that's been released here binds to that, opens up, and the calcium then rushes into the cytosol and acts then as a second messenger. The other possible second messenger is this particular material here. The DAG acts on a protein kinase C, which is bound to the membrane. It gets turned on and then begins acting on proteins to phosphorylate them, and that has some sort of activity downstream. Notice, since it's a kinase, you're actually transferring a phosphate, typically from ATP to ADP, onto the protein, and you get these cellular responses. What does that calcium do? Well, the calcium can also act on the protein kinase to stimulate it. It can also act on a variety of other kinases and other materials to then become, take that protein and make it an active protein with the phosphatase. The interesting thing here is this calcium, CAM. Does anybody know what that CAM is? Was it? Calmodulin. That's exactly correct. Calmodulin is a protein, or a protein cassette, as it were, that can be used over and over, attached to a protein, and then when that calmodulin attaches to the protein, then the protein becomes sensitive to calcium levels. So calmodulin is a structure that's designed to bind calcium. Calmodulin, calcium. Calmodulin, calcium. Don't ever forget that. So the high levels of calcium bind to this reusable, as it were. In other words, you see it over and over in different proteins. This calmodulin-like structure that's a part of the kinase that turns on that kinase, and then you get either actions that's turned on or turned off. How do you turn off this IP3? Well, there's this inositol polyphosphate phosphatase, or inositol phosphatase, and it changes it from one phosphate, from three phosphates to one, and then IP2 is inactive. Notice the power of a single phosphate moving from a sugar that's got three phosphates on it to a sugar that only has two. This has powerful regulatory actions, not just here but other places. This, with one phosphate, not so much. It's amazing. It is amazing. All right, calcium acts as a second messenger. External concentration, about 10 to the minus 3 molar, or 1 millimolar. Internal is about 10 to the minus 6. So it's 1 micromolar inside the cytosol and about 1 millimolar in the exterior and also in the endoplasmic reticulum. It binds to calmodulin, that protein that can capture up two sets of two ions, so a total of four calciums. All right, let's take a look at calmodulin. Calmodulin actually has, it is a symmetrical molecule in which one part of it here, one part of it is called this calcium finger. And notice all made up of alpha helices with some random coil in there. And the calcium sits in a calcium finger. If you look carefully at up near the top, it's hard to see here, but you see there are four loops. Two of the loops capture one of the calciums. When they look at it in three dimensions, the calciums sit in this loop right here. They're in the enzyme. There's a total of... There's two loops at the top. I mean, two sets of fingers at the top, two sets of fingers at the bottom, so it can hold up to four calciums. The intensity, the response, is based on the number of calcium that bind. In other words, that calcium, there are four calcium there. So the first calcium has some effects, second and third have additional effects. It's not additive. It's not a cooperative effect. It's more linear than cooperative. So the first one that binds and the second and third and fourth all have different levels of response. I don't think it's even linear, but I certainly know it's not cooperative. So, again, you see this molecule bound either covalently or simple by simple allosteric attachment to other proteins, and that protein then becomes sensitive to calcium levels. Calmodulin, calcium concentration. So we've talked about three. Three soluble second messengers and one insoluble second messenger or membrane-bound second messenger. The first one we talked about. First one we talked about as far as soluble second messenger systems was the following. That's this thing. Which is what? What's the second messenger here? Cyclic AMP is the second messenger, and it acts in conjunction with R2C2, which is known as what? Right. That's cyclic AMP. Maybe it's just three soluble. I was having to think and talk at the same time, and I don't do that really well. All right, so there is two second soluble second messengers here. That's this IP3 and calcium. So I guess it's three second messengers, CAMP, IP3, calcium. Those are soluble. Then we talked about a membrane-bound second messenger known as DAG, which stands for what? Diacylglycerol. And lastly, this is an enzyme cascade. It's not a second messenger system per se, because these things don't behave like a second messenger, that they don't have any activity of themselves. They simply bind to something else that causes it. But this is an enzyme cascade system that does the regulation of it. So we've talked a lot about regulation, and we're going to see a lot more as we go on. Now, we've got the last, I think this is the last, no. Oh, we have one more after the glycogen metabolism regulation. Okay, that's another, one more, was it? No, it isn't. Is there? Oh, I think it is the last one. Yeah, glycogen metabolism regulation. This is the last one, ladies and gentlemen. It's one of the harder ones as well, but it is one of the last ones. Glossary quiz, summary quiz, see list. Questions 4, 6, 9, and 10. Read 414. This is for the biochem majors. That's where we talked about the scattered plot. It has to do with ligand binding. Now, the timing on this is what? What's the timing on this? Let's not get wobbly near the end. What's the timing on this? We have a test next week, really? Seriously? You want to do it after that? This is actually a part of the studying for the test. Right? Yeah, it is. So, what I'm going to do is, let's see here, while you study for the test, you can learn this stuff. Now, I'll make you one deal, though. I'll make you a deal, and you're going to have to remind me of this. Has anybody started the glycogen metabolism pathway? Yeah. Have you already done it? Okay. I was not going to put it on the test. Is that okay if I not put it on the test? Okay, that's okay with you? All right. So I'll not put this on the test. So that means you are not required to do it until after the test. All right? So this particular metabolism regulation will be due after the test. We'll talk about more about that test. When's the test? What, Wednesday of next week? Yeah. So sometime after Wednesday of next week, we're going to do this. This chapter will be on the test, and so will the summary and the terms as well. Now, no, the glossary and the summary. So the glossary quizzes are becoming less and less less and less obnoxious, as it were, because they're getting smaller and smaller. So this will be due, let's see, if we do the three-day thing, including today, that would make it what? Friday, but we don't do anything on Friday, and we don't do anything on Monday. So this will be Tuesday. So this is going to be due Tuesday of next week. And you can use it as a part of your study, because I'll just make sure I include some of the summary things of this on the test so you can feel positive about it. Homework will be due next week after the test. All right? So the homework will not be on the test. The glycogen metabolism regulation pathway will not be on the test. Oh, no, I didn't say that. I said some parts of this will not be on the test, but chapter 13 is going to be on the test. 13 will be on the test. Parts of 14 will be on the test. Yes, what?
Just so it's clear, it's 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, parts of 14, 24, 25, and 26?
Correct. You know, actually, I woke up last night and I seriously thought about having this test cover 2 days. Oh, a take-home test. Those are pathetic. No. No take-home tests. No, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's going to be that. It's going to be exactly what he said. Okay? Thank you.